This is an interview with Betty Roberts. This is tape 26, side 2.
Okay.
Well, we're talking about the current ballot measure. I've talked to Kit about it, and she just is really convinced that that we can't trust future courts, and therefore she wants it in the Constitution, and that's more protection. You know, so we would just have simple disagreement. Mm-hmm. I think on some of the other cases, I suppose next important in terms of it having some real impact, I would select a criminal case, State versus Carraher, which brought us full circle from using the state constitution to decide search and seizure cases in the 30s, 40s, 50s, so for a very long period of time, to moving to using the federal constitution search and seizure clause and the holdings by the United States Supreme Court back again to using the state constitution. And this probably only makes sense to lawyers and to law students, and perhaps to people in law enforcement, about whether we should rely on the state constitution or the federal constitution, when generally our provisions both say the same thing, and that is that individuals will be protected in their papers and their personal belongings and their property from unreasonable police searches and taking seizure of property. And so since both of our provisions say generally the same thing and protect the same right to not have police intruding into our homes and into our lives, that probably doesn't make any difference. But it does make a difference, because if we followed the federal constitution, we follow every case, we follow the most recent pronouncements by the United States Supreme Court on what they consider to be unreasonable. And so if we simply follow what the United States Supreme Court says is reasonable, what's the good of having a state constitutional provision if it's never used? Is there ever any time when we should use the state constitution? Professors and legal scholars, of course, who have advocated the use of state constitutions know their history well. Now, Hans Lindy, of course, being a really important expert, national expert, and national advocate of a return to state constitutions, know that state constitutions were written long before the federal constitution was written. There were 13 states. Every state had a constitution. And they all had Bill of Rights. I think all of them. Maybe one did not, but certainly was added. And in those original constitutions, there was the search and seizure provisions. And as, of course, the country expanded westward, the western Midwest states, the western states, simply adopted their constitutions of what already existed on the East Coast and in the states there.
Did they evolve as they
evolved? Sure, different kinds of provisions and different kinds of constitution, and sometimes more more specific about rights. For example, in the federal constitution, there's only one reference to religion under the separation of church and state, which just says that in the First Amendment that there should be a free exercise of religion, and that the government, you know, cannot impose upon religious practices. In effect, that's what it says, and nor can the government favor one religion over another. In other words, the government has to stay neutral as far as religion is concerned. The Oregon Constitution refers to religious freedom three times. It specifically says that no money can be paid to religious organizations from the state treasurer. Mm. It specifically says there shall be a free exercise of religion, so on. So that as, depending upon who was writing the state constitutions, mm-hmm. and what their feelings were on some of these issues, many of these kinds of provisions were expanded or repeated, so that it says, you know, we really mean this. There's not going to be, you know, any involvement of government with religion. At any rate, state constitutions came first. Then the federal system, which means a sharing of power. The state said, we will give up some of our power for central government. It's important that we do this, that we have this big central government who can give us domestic tranquility when there's an uprising, that they can regulate commerce, that they can carry on foreign policy, that they can tax us, and that they can build roads, you know, and all these sorts of things. And so it was important that states give to the federal government this kind of authority. So in the modern, now, return to state constitutions, and it has been a real movement among judges for about the last 15 years, that it seemed as though the states abdicated the civil rights to the United States Supreme Court through the 60s and through the early 70s at least. And the reason much of this was abdicated during that period of time was that states were not using their Bill of Rights for the protection of all citizens. Blacks were being denied the right to vote. I suppose the best example, not being able to go to the schools with white children. Much discrimination going on, and so the state constitutions were not being applied in that manner. So the U.S. Supreme Court said, and in criminal cases such as the Miranda case, the right to be told of the charges against one when being arrested, and read their right to counsel and so on. This was not being done on the local level. So the U.S. Supreme Court sort of filled a vacuum, a void, and said, wait a minute. We are setting a standard, and you at least have to adhere to this standard. So the federal constitution is the level at which all states have to, all states must reach that
sort of
level of protection.
Standard.
Yes, a minimum standard. But under state constitutions, you can go further. You can say, this is the minimum. It meets the federal requirement. Mm-hmm. Now, does our state constitution grant greater protections for our citizens in Oregon than the federal government grants under the federal constitution? And so the argument is there may be situations where the state constitution should grant more rights. Mm-hmm. And we just did it in Hewitt versus Safe. Mm-hmm. We said we have an ERA. I don't know what the federal government... probably it's not needed in the federal system either, but depending upon who the Supreme Court justices are at any given time. So we expanded our state constitution in that case. In the state versus Carraher, many of the cases that were coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court were giving police much more license to search. They were expanding what is reasonable and limiting what is unreasonable, so that it was so that many judges were saying, you know, my gosh, we can't give the police this much authority. Mm-hmm. Can they go in and search a house just because some unreliable person has said they're doing drugs in there? Can they search a person, take a person out of an automobile, and then without asking for permission to search a car, open the trunk? Mm-hmm. Where does the police, what's the limit? Mm-hmm. What's reasonable, what's unreasonable? So when State versus Carraher came to the court, there already had been a lot of discussion about moving the state back in criminal law to using the state constitution rather than the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit that Hans Lindy really worked on me on this. Said, Betty, this is an ideal case. Here we've been talking about using the state constitution again, which we did originally. Then we went to the federal constitution. Now let's come back to the state constitution and say, from now on, we're going to use the state constitution for search and seizure. And that's what State versus Carraher did.
In what and kind of a form would he be working on you? Privately or in these conferences? Or how would he...
Oh, you mean how'd he lobby me?
Yeah.
Well, he just came to my office, okay. You know, and says, this is a great case. Well, what had happened in the briefs is that this had been raised. And the point is, you see, if you decide, if a Supreme Court case decides it on the state constitution only, that's the final word. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, the case meets the minimum requirement of the federal constitution. So we have to grant the protection, the minimum protection. If we go further, then there's no appeal. So lawyers who need to be instructed on how to argue their case and how to prepare their briefs and what provision, whether state constitution or federal constitution that they're relying upon. The sort of internal background here was that Mick Gillette, and he's not on the Supreme Court yet, he's still over the Court of Appeals. When Mick was Assistant Attorney General or Solicitor General, which he was, but he was arguing a lot of cases, and he was able to convince the Supreme Court early in his career at the AG's office that it would be much more simple if the Supreme Court would simply adopt the cases coming out of the federal court. And then everybody would know what is the rule.
How do they do that? How do you adopt?
Well, what happens once an opinion comes out is there's a lot of police training that goes on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, all policemen are trained in the criminal provisions and what you have to do. Here's the procedure to meet a reasonable search and seizure. And a reasonable search and seizure is getting an affidavit from a judge, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. Unless there are some exigent circumstances, meaning circumstances that I don't have time to go and get a judge to sign this.
Right.
And if there's exigent circumstances, then the question is, then those circumstances have to be analyzed. You know, what were they really? Exigent circumstances, or could this policeman have called in and said, "Hey, get me an affidavit and a search warrant ready. I'll be in. Here's my information," and the affidavit accompanies the search and seizure order, and then the judge reads the affidavit, says, "I'm convinced by what this police officer says that there is reasonable basis to search this place." Mm-hmm. And or this person and places, whatever. And so you take the search warrant and serve it. Mm-hmm. But the judge, this person who has examined the evidence, is making the decision in a cool, collected manner rather than a police officer who says, "I want to make this arrest, and I'm just going to go ahead and do it, mm-hmm. no matter what." Mm-hmm. And you know, police officers lose cases because they do that. It gets thrown out on it's an unreasonable search and seizure. So police are trained. Don't do a bad search and seizure. I mean, we've got it in the O.J. Simpson case right now.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the guy the detective who went over the fence and picked up the glove, was that an unreasonable search and seizure? Mm-hmm. Or could he have gone back to the police station and they gone and told his story, gone to the judge, and said, I need a search warrant. Based upon, I went to OJ's home, saw his car there, and I believe that there is that a crime is being committed or has been committed, and I should investigate. Well, of course, now we know what the detective says. He said, "Hey, I saw the blood drops. I didn't know what was going on in there." Is that exigent circumstances? so that he doesn't have to get a search warrant. So all I'm saying, Clark, is that the court case only sets off this whole chain of events that goes back down to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And the law enforcement then says, whoops, we got these guidelines here. And now we got to follow these guidelines. So here's what we do in to police officer. You have to get your search warrant if you're going to do thus and so. Well, you know, it's a Mick Gillette's argument was, if we follow the federal cases, then everybody's going to know, and all the police are going to know what it is all over this whole country, and we're all going to be alike, and we're all going to enforce the same kinds of mm-hmm. procedures. So if they say something was exigent circumstances, then it's going to be exigent circumstances all over the country. And it's the, quote, bright line. Lawyers like to use this term, the bright line. Police like to use this. Give us a bright line so that we know this is not permitted, this is permitted. Well, unfortunately, it's hard to draw bright lines mm-hmm. when you start talking about the facts of a crime, because they're all different. And so I began to see Hans Lindy's point of view that, you know, it's going to be better if we can develop our own law in the state of Oregon with our own kind of police enforcement, who get their own training, and then mm-hmm. we're not always relying on what will the U.S. Supreme Court do next mm-hmm. kind of thing. And his argument, of course, is we can develop a brighter line if we simply do it under the state constitution and still meeting the minimum requirements. And there might be times when we want to interpret the facts in a particular case differently than the U.S. Supreme Court would interpret it. Yeah. Because the U.S. Supreme Court has tended to be quite conservative in this and to be very prosecution-oriented yeah. and giving police a great deal of leeway. And another part of criminal law that's being debated is whether evidence can be used that was unlawfully obtained in a trial. And there are those who believe that it ought to be used, but the exclusionary rule is called, and that it ought to be used, but it ought to go to the weight of what the jury decides. Well, those who've said no, if it doesn't meet the constitutional requirement of a reasonable search, it's not admitted. Period. Mm-hmm. That's the exclusionary rule. Mm-hmm. You don't get to use it, guys, if you don't do it right. Mm-hmm. And it's made a really strong impression, I guess, on police enforcement. That they, if the court should rule in the O.J. Simpson case that the glove is not admissible because it was illegally, unlawfully seized, it really hurts the prosecution's case. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a long lesson on search and seizure, I guess, but that's what State versus Carraher was all about. Mick and I went to lunch one day while I was working on State versus Carraher, and which he and I did from time to time. And I could pick his brains about what was going on in the Court of Appeals, and he could do the same thing with me about Supreme Court. So I said during the course of our lunch, I said, Mick, I'm working on an opinion you're not going to like very well when it comes out. And he knew immediately what I was talking about, and I intended that he would know, because I wanted to know what his reaction was. Is he had gotten the court to say, okay, we're going to go the federal route, and he had advocated that all along, still thinking we've got the bright line, judges are going to tell us, and he pleaded with me, said, Betty, don't do it, you know, we can't flop all over the place every two or three decades, And I said, Mick, it makes so much sense to me to just go ahead and use the state constitution. Well, so he went back to Court of Appeals pretty much holding his head and troubled by the fact that this opinion was going to come out. And so after it was out, I said to him, well, you know, what'd you think of it? And he said, I still don't think we should have done it. After I was off the court and I was teaching at Oregon State University, I had him over for a class once. And he got off on the use of the state constitution. He was on the Supreme Court because he took my place there after I resigned. And he started talking about the use of the state constitution. And he talked about how we'd return to the search and seizure. And he was very complimentary about all of this and how they were using it. And so I could hardly wait till the class was over. And I said, Mac, do you remember that conversation we had on state versus Carraher? And he looked at me and he realized what I was referring to. And I said, what's happened to you? And he looked at me just as deadpan as could be and said, I changed my mind.
Wow.
And I said, oh, you're a judge on the Supreme Court now. So you get the last word.
And you think that your discussions with him on this have been pivotal?
Oh, I think what happened to him is after that he got over to the Supreme Court, Hans worked on him, Lindy, undoubtedly. I'm sure. And I think that he began to see that as a Supreme Court judge, that he then could help draw that bright line. Right. And that from his perspective of now being involved at in a different way, that it was okay use the state constitution.
But interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So sort of depends upon, I guess, where you're coming from. So what other kinds of cases do we want to talk about?
The state versus Carraher was decided by what kind of a margin?
On the principle of using the state constitution again, I think it was unanimous. It was very interesting. Sometimes when you're working with these cases and you're involved in the policy making of it or the constitutional interpretation of it, you kind of lose track of the facts until you then, after you've done what you wanted to do with the case, you have to say, well, now given all of these guidelines that have been set up in the case, we return to the facts and we say, now how should these facts be decided? So this was a case in which a woman was arrested and she was in the police car, and in the police car the police searched her purse and found some drugs. She was claiming that was an unreasonable search and seizure because that was her private property. When I got to the end of State versus Carraher, I wrote two separate conclusions as to the outcome of the case, whether to affirm or to reverse, because I felt that under those circumstances, and there were more circumstances than just that put me kind of in the middle road here, that it could go one way or the other in terms of what we had set out, that the purse was going to be taken from her at the police station. Did she have a right to privacy in that after she got there and so on? And she had been dealing drugs. That was why she was arrested. She was dealing on the street. It was one of those, maybe it was unreasonable, maybe it wasn't, So I wrote two separate conclusions on how we were holding and put them both into conference.
Is that unusual?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it was unusual. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know how my other judges were going to... What I wanted was to get them to, again, use the state constitution for search and seizure cases. That was the purpose in taking the case in the first place. If we weren't going to do anything with it,
right?
Why take the case? Mm-hmm. Whatever the Court of Appeals said was okay. Mm-hmm. They simply looked at the facts and said, yes, this is reasonable, no, it isn't, whatever. Unless we were going to make some new law of some sort. Why? So my concentration had been on how do I convince the judges this is where we should go. So I wrote two conclusions, affirm or reverse. And after then we talked about all of the what I thought was important and everybody else thought was important. Do we go back to use the state constitution? The chief justice said, well, Betty, where are you on your alternative conclusions? And I said, I really don't care. I'm with the majority. You guys vote, and I'll be with the majority. Huh. And I know that sounds weird because I should feel very strongly about whether this woman's purse was searched. Under the circumstances, I didn't feel that it really made that much difference in terms of that particular factual situation because of what was about to happen to her anyway. Mm-hmm. She was going to be charged with drug dealing. And she was, and her possessions were going to be taken from her. When they were no longer in her possessions, they were in possessions of the police. The police were going to inventory everything they took from her. Mm-hmm. And it would have been different if, I think, if it had been, certainly would have been very different, if it had been a different situation, different factual situation. And so, you know, to me, in giving guidelines to the police, this one, we could explain the outcome either way. Mm-hmm. We could explain, no, you should not have taken the purse. You should not have looked in the purse at that point. You should have waited till it was in your possession when you had to inventory the contents. You know, we could say that, big deal. Or we could say, given the facts in this situation where she was going to be booked and put in jail, that, you know, that this is it. So at least that's the way I recall the facts. I haven't reread the facts for years and years. So, you know, at any rate, the facts were such that it really was not that important to me in terms of this, how this happened to this defendant. So the majority, as I recall, decided that the conviction would hold and that the, you know, that it was not an unreasonable search. The point is that we returned to using the state constitution.
That was the more important issue.
Well, for a Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we talk about justice and fairness and being concerned about the litigants, but there are the overriding issues of of the whole law. What's the law going to be that gives the guidance? And in this case, it was the overall law that was more important than than that deciding that particular case.
So, were there other major cases, cases?
I spend too much time on these cases with you, Clark. Probably somebody can look them up and go and read them if they're interested. But I think one other one that we might talk about. And I won't take so long on this one, was Burt versus Blumenauer, which really, I think, is not one that very many people would pay attention to, but certainly decision makers in government, at least at the local level, well, on state level too, certainly ought to know it. And it was one in which a ballot measure was being proposed by Multnomah County that would add fluoridation to fluoride to drinking water supply, and by some procedure, this was going to be on the ballot to let the voters decide whether it should be done. And it's always been an issue whether it should be or not for the health of citizens' teeth. Whether this was something that should be automatically put in the water, just like chlorine. Or other chemicals, and there are those who oppose it, who say this is medication, and it, you know, if people want to use it, they can put it in their own water. So at any rate, it was referred to the voters, and in the process of the campaign, the Multnomah County actually raised money. Or used money. I don't think they raised money. They used money to print pamphlets and to have them distributed to voters explaining the benefits of putting fluoride in the water. And this was challenged on the basis that that was improper government function to put an issue on the ballot and then attempt to influence by using taxpayers' money the outcome of the election. That government was to, what was intriguing to me about this case was the relationship between government and its citizens. Can government propose something and then use the citizens' money to, in a sense, force it on them? Or to propagandize them to vote for it? or to somehow or other influence that. And it when Maureen and I were working on it together, and Maureen did an awful lot of work on this particular case, but when we were working on it, and I remember I was working on it one day here at home, I was reading a lot of the background material, and when on days that I would work at home, we were on the telephone two or three times a day, she and I just sort of checking on things and talking about things, and I said to her, you know, I feel like I'm back in a political science class, where we're talking about what can government do